swoop in low towards Slusson's fortress. Already the air is peppered with laser fire, and the blast popped the front of the halo. Now! Temin thinks. He takes control of the guns with a flip of a switch, then turns the rail throwers forward and up. His fingers squeeze the triggers. Thin nanofiber rail tubes rattle off, the cannon firing them at hundreds of rounds per second. They chew through the Black Rock Tower. Stone coughs up in chips and splinters. The tower, like a notched tree, begins to fall. And it falls right onto two of the TIE fighters. It takes one out clean, crushing it in midair, leaving nothing left but a burning streak across Temin's vision. The other catches debris against its wing panel, and suddenly the thing spirals downward like a bird with its wings sliced off. John claps the boy on the shoulder.
Quick thinking, kid. Let's go get our people and get the hell out of here.
What has my son become?
That question sticks in Nora's belly like a knife. Her thoughts, her awareness, sit separate from her actions, almost like she's two different people. Like one of her is the internal version, this sudden bundle of fear and worry. The other is Nora the soldier, Nora the pilot, Nora who retakes control of the weapon system and peppers the fortress with laser fire. Inside, she's a tumult of feelings, all of them fighting for supremacy, like whole planetary systems desperate to dominate one another. Her son is doing exactly what he's supposed to do. He's fighting for the New Republic. The Empire is their enemy. What he did was smart, sharp, and demonstrative of his capability, meaning that now he is both soldier and pilot too. Is that what she wanted for him? He's young. He's only 15. Though, she's reminded, his birthday is coming up soon. Time moves fast, and it only gets faster when you have children. He just took out 2 TIE fighters. No, he killed 2 pilots. 2 lives snuffed out. The problem isn't whether they deserved their fates. Those pilots signed up for war and knew what came with it. The problem is what that makes Temin. It haunts her. Suddenly, will it haunt him? Is he too young to even understand what's happening? Will one day he awaken to ghosts in his head? Or will he toughen to it too quickly? Will it kill the kindness inside him and make him mean like John Burrell? These thoughts tear her apart inside, even as she does her duty. Nora operates the guns and fires, even as Temin brings the ship alongside the feeding room entrance, even as she lays down suppressing fire and cuts apart the masked guards who rush up to defend Kanker's empire.
There,
Jom says, placing a hand on her forearm. His voice seems distant. Everything seems distant. Her pulse kicks in her chest, in her neck, in her wrists. Adrenaline eats her up the way those rail throwers gnawed apart the palace tower. She blinks and pushes past all that. In the feeding room, 2 guards rush up to the edge. But before they can do anything, both of them shudder and pitch face forward into the fog, bodies plunging. Coming up behind them are Jazz and Sinjir. The former has a blaster out and is using her free hand to help support the latter. Sinjir hobbles along, his arm hanging limp at his side. One of the TIEs swoops in from above, and Nora quickly turns the rail throwers toward him as Temin slides the halo up to the entryway. A quick burst sends the TIE pivoting back into the sky, momentarily dissuaded. With Jazz and Sinjir back on board, Jom says to the boy,
"Punch it!"
And Nora's blood goes from her brain to her feet as the halo accelerates fast through the atmosphere above Vorlag, the TIE fighter hopping on their trail and following close behind. Chapter 3. Sloan stands in the center of a glowing blue circle and speaks to the galaxy.
This is Grand Admiral Ray Sloan, commander of the Imperial Navy and de facto leader of the Galactic Empire. The Empire remains vigilant in combating the anarchist criminal government calling itself the New Republic. The dream of a safe, sane, and unified galaxy did not die with the glorious Emperor Palpatine. The Galactic Empire continues to march forward, tirelessly diligent in its quest to return order and stability where none before existed. Meanwhile, the New Republic continues its own mission to destroy what we have built together. Crime has returned to the galaxy tenfold as the underworld dynasties have regained dominance over worlds once kept free of their toxic influences by the Empire. Supply lines have been cut, and many worlds are now starving without adequate food. The corrosive influence of the New Republic has caused a seemingly insurmountable loss of jobs, income, and even lives. This is the moment, she thinks. Sloan puts steel in her spine, and what was it her new advisor said to her? Bronze in your voice. She continues. But fear not. The Empire remains as sure as a mountain, as certain as the stars across all the systems. We will defeat the insurgency. We will make this false government pay for its crimes against you. Even now, we are building new ships, new bases, and founding new technologies to keep you safe. The Empire is coming. We will deliver you from harm, and we will strike back against our enemies. Remain calm. Remain loyal. With true hearts, victory for us and for the whole galaxy will soon be at hand. She gives a curt nod, and the blue glow around her dissipates. The circle goes dark, and for a moment, she's left alone in the lightless room, listening to the murmuring sounds and shuffling feet. It is a moment of peace, rare and precious, and she clings to it like a child holding a doll. Then the lights come back on, and once again, her new life resumes. This room is the Office of Imperial Promotion, Galactic Truth, and Fact Correction. Most just call it the OIP. It grew out of the ashes of Compnor to countermand the influence of the New Republic across systems and sectors. Sloan is here a lot, much to her chagrin. Over walks Ferrick Obdur with his assistant. A pretty thing with skin so pale Sloan can see the dark veins beneath her skin. And they help Sloan down off the projection platform. Obdur is older than she is, an irascible cad with sharp tufts of silver hair coming off his cheeks, jowls, and chin. He's something of a relic of the old days. Obdur was a young man in the army during the tumultuous shift from the Republic to the Empire. He helped design the informational assault that soothed the galaxy in its transition. Which is why Ferrick Obdur is now the Chief Informational Officer, a role Sloan assigned to him, but not by her own choice. Rather, it was assigned through her. Obdur is smiling, always smiling, a glint in his eyes, like he thinks he knows more than everyone else in the room.
Grand Admiral Sloan, a fine job, if a bit stiff.
I was told to put steel in my spine, so I did.
Of course, of course. You did fine, just fine. Here, over this way. I have some images I need you to look at.
He directs her to a long metal table against the far wall, a table inlaid with lights that he flicks on. He opens a folder and lets a series of translucent pages slide out. The light beneath them makes their colors and inks pop.
These are posters, as you can see. We'll hang them on worlds both safe and contested.
One poster depicts two stormtroopers handing out a basket of fruits to a human family in need. Another shows a small battalion of New Republic troops, portrayed as dirty, unshaven slobs in ill-fitting helmets, pointing flamethrower streams at the front gates of an Imperial Academy. In that image, children are seen at the windows, screaming against the glass. A third image shows another series of scowling Republic soldiers, these with the shadow of a hut slug behind them. Abdur pulls that one toward him.
I don't much care for this. Too subtle. The goal is, of course, to infer the connection between the rebels and the criminal organizations. But we need to do more than infer. We need that connection to be clear, concise. A hard slap to the face. A dose of reality.
Reality, Sloane thinks. What grave irony. None of this is real. And she says as much. Why are we resorting to these exaggerations when truth will out? We have facts on our side. The Empire is stability. The galaxy is too big to be left to its own devices, and the New Republic would let them govern themselves, which sounds fine in theory.
Your weapons in this war are ships and blasters and armor. My weapon in this war is words. And even more important than words are images. Pictures depicting an artistic representation of reality. Facts are flexible, and these graphics point to the truth of which you speak, even if they do not precisely portray them.
Abdur lays a steadying hand on her forearm. He may mean it to comfort, but it does no such thing. She wrenches her arm away, and then catches his wrist and gives it a hard twist.
I am Grand Admiral Sloane. I am not some girlish assistant for you to paw or comfort or cajole. Touch me again, and I will have the offending limb removed, and all the nerves of the stump obliterated, so that no robotic hand will ever respond to your commands.
His face goes ashen. Though to his credit, his smile never fades. Instead, Abdur offers a few gruff chuckles.
An error on my part, Admiral. You are right. 1,000 apologies.
He licks his lips.
Do we have your approval of these images, or do we need to revise?
Sloane hesitates. Acid backs up in her throat like venom. It kills her, but finally she concedes.
Let them go as is. You have approval.
It hits her then, clear as a blaster bolt to the center of her forehead.
I'm no longer an admiral. I'm a politician.
The chill that grapples up her spine will not be suppressed. The only rescue she has from this is her own assistant, Adia Wright. A bright young woman, strong and determined, not to mention provably loyal. Sloane thought the girl was lost to her, but the reach of the Fleet Admiral Gallius Rax is quite far indeed. He has people on the inside of the New Republic, and getting her away from Chandrilla, before she was ever put in a prison cell, was a favor he paid to Sloane. One for which she is truly thankful, because the Empire needs more Adia Wrights and fewer Ferric Abdurs.
Admiral,
Adia says.
You should be the one doing this,
Sloane says under her breath.
It should be you in charge of our propaganda efforts.
I'm sure they're doing their best, and I do my best at your side.
At that, Sloane finds a rare smile.
What's next in my day?
A new entry in your schedule.
Oh?
He requests your presence.
Oh.
Him. Gallius Rax. Her advisor.
When?
Now, Admiral.
With steel in her spine and bronze in her voice, she says,
Shall we?
What Ray Sloan knows about Fleet Admiral Gallius Rax amounts to very little. What she does know is this. He appears in the naval roster 2 decades ago. Rax's debut at the age of 20 was at an abnormally high ranking for someone with little to no history. He joined up and immediately was assigned to the NIA, the Naval Intelligence Agency, and given the rank of commander. His reports bypassed his superiors, skipping even the offices of Vice Admirals Rancid and Screed. Instead, his reports were eyes only for Wolf Yularen, who perished on the first Death Star during the Strike Force assault by rebel terrorists. Once Yularen perished, Rax's reports went right to the top, to Emperor Palpatine himself. Worst of all, most of those reports remain 90% redacted, and that means they remain almost entirely incomprehensible. She has the dates of his service in the NIA under Yularen, and then under Palpatine, and that is all the usable information Adia was able to pilfer from the records. Examining the non-redacted portions of his reports did little to complete the picture. From it, she surmised that most of his operations were kept to the Outer Rim. But she was out there, too, and had never even heard of him until the last few years. After that, the information about him is distressingly thin. He is considered a hero of the Galactic Empire, and has collected a host of medals, the Nova Star, the Medal of Service, the Galactic War on Insurgency Medal, the Gilded Sun, and the vaunted, if ambiguous, Emperor's Will Medal. And yet information on how he gained these, or when he was even awarded them, remains unlisted. Rax is a specter. Once just a name, but suddenly summoned and made manifest. That is how she feels whenever she meets him, as if she is meeting the hologram of a dead man made to pass as real. That feeling is no different even now. She steps into his chamber. He is taken to meeting her here, in his quarters, rather than on the bridge.
"That is your territory," he told her. "I do not control this fleet. You do." She filled in the rest of his statement inside her own head. "But I control you, Grand Admiral Sloan."
His chamber is far less austere than the expected Imperial aesthetic. He has punctuated the grays and blacks with punches of color, a strange red tapestry on the wall, whose labyrinthine intricacy is maddening if you stare at it too long. A cylindrical tank of diaphanous water creatures flitting about, their organs glowing different colors. A golden chain connecting 2 sickle-shaped vibroblades, the weapon hanging in its own blast glass case with a light on it to reveal the ornate scrollwork etched into it. At present, a new color fills the room. The blue glow of a galactic map. Sloan can see the territorial divisions, and it makes it easy to identify as the present state of political unrest. The galaxy has been butchered and stitched back together into an ugly quilt. Some systems have gone over to the New Republic, with just as many separating into their own fiefdoms. The portions of the galaxy that the Empire controls dwindle. The New Republic has had a deleterious effect. Their assault has been ceaseless and effective. Even just looking at this map suddenly overwhelms her. Anxiety crawls inside her. But Rax seems unfazed by that anxiety, which she believes should be comforting, but instead only serves to make her feel all the more alone. There he stands. No longer garbed in an admiral's uniform, but rather in a floor-length robe. Red as blood, that robe. When he meets with others, he tends to wear the raiment of a fleet admiral, his formal role while serving as her so-called advisor. But here, in his chambers, he is often garbed more comfortably. He turns toward her with that confident, feral sneer fixed to his face. One eyebrow arches,
and he spreads his arms.
Admiral Sloan, thank you for coming.
As if I had any choice.
When the puppeteer works the strings.
Of course,
is all she says in response.
How is our empire doing?
That, said with no small irony. The sarcasm there is applied with such a thin layer, it would be undetectable to most. But Ray hears it. She recalls his words one night, months ago.
That is no longer our galaxy.
He explained to her then that they had lost. That the empire she served was... What were his words? Inelegant. Crude.
Steel in my spine, bronze in my voice.
We are focusing overmuch on the battles of propaganda. Hearts and minds will be swayed by military victories over the New Republic, not posters shellacking cantina walls.
He hums, then walks through the floating ghosts of the galactic map with a dramatic step and a showy gesticulation of his hand.
You raise a good point. Military action is not yet in our stars, but tell Abdur to find some footage of us routing the Republic traitors. Battle footage. Violent, but not too violent. We must look like the hero conquerors, not thugs. Would that assuage your worries, Admiral Sloan?
No,
she thinks, but instead she nods stiffly.
It's a start, but I am uncomfortable, increasingly uncomfortable, with all this artifice.
He stops her there.
Ray, do you know much about opera?
What?
Opera. The Nonagon cycle. The Esdrit and the Thalothian. The masterwork of Ilor Beelthrak. Even the Huts had their own opera. A rather disgusting narrative of betrayal and breeding. The Lachispa Carsona. He makes a sour face. The galaxy should be spared singing from such worms.
I know opera, though I am not an enthusiast.
He clasps his hands together.
Become one. It will make our partnership more rewarding for you.
Opera moves me, and yet none of it is real. Therein lies the crux of what you need to understand. Something does not need to be real for it to have an effect. The instruments and song, the drama and melodrama, the pathos and tragedy, it's a lie, a fiction.
And yet what happens on the stage speaks a kind of truth just the same. Facts and truth are separate things. I am more interested in truth than I am fact. I am comfortable with artifice when it suits our needs. And here, it does.
But...
He seems suddenly impatient. His nostrils flare and his hands tighten into fists.
We agree that the New Republic is dangerous. Do we not?
We do, of course.
We can see that because we are elevated minds.
But most?
They're fools. I know you agree with me on that. And so as long as you and I know the reality, I see nothing wrong with pushing weak minds to a conclusion we have already reached. They need that kind of drama and melodrama to get them to an understanding that was easy for you and me. We came to it naturally. Others must be nudged, even pushed. Is that more clear?
Sloane swallows hard. Though his voice is calm and measured, the anger is plain on his face. He crackles with a kind of quiet intensity. Once, a lifetime ago, she was refueling her battleship, the Dreadstar, at a floating depot on the Sea of Karowak, on the ninth moon of Tilth. A storm was incoming, and the sea took on this look. The waves turned gunmetal gray, and though those waves stayed low, They churned and frothed. When the storm finally hit, the sea became like a monster. Rax reminds her of that.
When will the sea become a storm? Will he become a monster?
Perhaps she is too paranoid.
It is clear,
she says finally.
What is less clear is our goal.
He grins. Our goal is the resurgence of the Empire. A stronger, leaner Empire.
Yes, but how? We have made no overtures to Mas Amida, who remains entrenched on Coruscant. Will we elect another Emperor? Though our meeting on Akiva was a dangerous and callow deception.
She thinks, but does not say.
A necessary ruse. It does not eliminate the need for unity. We have Moffs rebelling and claiming Palpatine is alive. We have Grand General Loring dug in on Malastare. We have...
Have faith in me, Rey. Faith will light our path. Let me worry about all these problems. Those are future concerns. In the present, I have tasks for you. One for the moment, but more to come after.
Tasks. Like she's an errand girl, tackling a to-do list. That feeling is an odd one for her.
Is it because she controls the Empire in name, but not in reality? Is it because she has no idea who Rax really is? Or if he is deserving of the honor required to command her?
Is it because she simply doesn't trust him? He begins to pace around the room, his hands clasped stiffly behind his back.
I need you to fetch someone for me.
Fetch? Another demeaning term. As if she is just a pet, chasing after a flung stick or kicked ball.
Who is it?
Brendel Hux.
That name. She knows it, doesn't she? Hux. 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 Commandant Hux?
She asks, suddenly.
At the Arcanus Academy?
Again, a strange and unnameable fear ripples through her.
Hux trains children.
The best and brightest the Empire had to offer.
The very same.
Arcanus is under siege by the New Republic forces as we speak. We are, in fact, losing that system.
Yes. And I want you to rescue him personally.
Rescue? Truly rescue? Or are you again speaking in metaphor?
It would not be the first time Sloane had been tasked with eradicating those in the Empire whom Gallius Rax considered inept or a competitor. The events on Akiva were only the beginning in that regard, and the list of the missing and dead at his hands has grown considerably since. Rax refers to the winnowing down of the Empire as the sharpening of a blade. But even still, she finds the idea troublesome, sickening even. He shows his teeth in a grin.
For now, rescue. Hopefully, he will appreciate our efforts, and in good faith, he'll join us. He has a child, a bastard boy, as I understand.
Not born of his wife Meritel, but of some kitchen woman.
Don't worry about the mother or the wife, but a child is a child, and blood is blood. So make sure the boy finds rescue as well.
Is it wise to devote resources to rescue his boy?
The Empire must be fertile and young. Children are crucial to our success. Many of our officers are old. We need that kind of vitality, that brand of energy get with the young. The Empire needs children.
The Empire needs children.
That sentence repeats in her mind again and again.
Each time it grows more terrifying.
And yet, he's not wrong, is he? The New Republic is driven by the young. Though it may be naive, its rebels are believers. They are vibrant, and though not always capable, driven. She adds,
we can reinstate some of the breeding programs from the earlier days of the Empire.
to encourage our people to start or grow their families. We can reward them for it.
His hands clap together. He beams.
Yes, I knew we made a good team, Ray. When we are done with the galaxy, there will be no worlds left to conquer. They will all be ours. Thank you.
She offers a reticent nod.
Of course.
Once all this messiness is complete and Hux is with us, I believe we may have our Shadow Council, and the future of the Empire will be clear.
Shadow Council? She doesn't even have to ask. The look on her face is enough to prompt Admiral Rax's response.
I'm sorry. I didn't tell you. I'm forming a Shadow Council to govern the Empire from behind the scenes. Only the finest of our kind. The first and highest order of Imperial minds. Once Hux is on board, we will have our inaugural meeting. You are, of course, a member, but more on this when you return. Safe travels, Admiral Sloan. May the stars speed your success.
Now go fetch,
she expects him to say. But all he does is turn around
and step once more into the blue glow of the star map.
Gallius Rax's words cling to her like a bad smell. Faith will light our path.
The Empire needs children. I'm forming a Shadow Council. This is not how you rule an empire. The man wants a cult, not a government.
The rumors about Palpatine always ranged from the strange to the sinister. Dark fairy tales of him sacrificing creatures or hunting children. Stories of him disappearing for months on end. Fears that the old man was eternal and had lived not one life, but many. No matter how true or how false those stories were, one fact remained true, which was that Palpatine never let the Empire fall into instability. He ruled as more than a politician, and more than some hooded theocrat.
Imperial worlds never went hungry. They never fell to lawlessness.
Though the galaxy was held fast and firm in the Empire's carbon-jacketed gauntlet,
that was for the good of the galaxy. A galaxy too big to be left to its own devices, too mad and too scattered to survive without strong governance and clear vision to unify it. If Palpatine knew one thing, it was to put people in place to run the machine. He trusted them. He let them do their jobs. The Emperor knew when to delegate.
Rax keeps too much too close. His hands on all the controls.
Sloan does not know what the endgame is here. That troubles her. Gallius Rax is so in love with artifice. So what, then, is he hiding?
Ahead, toward the turbo lift, Adia stands and waits. The girl's back is straight, and her eyes are flinty and clear. That is the pride of the Empire.
Adia Wright is the type of person they should be striving to elevate. An administrator, loyal and true. In love with data, logistics, cause and effect, truth and consequence. She is a much better Imperial than someone like Brendel Hux. A slithering thing who views people as tools and props. No wonder, she thinks, that Rax wants him kept alive. For a moment, Sloane's mind drifts to a fantasy where Adia Wright is more than just her assistant. Adia would make a fine daughter.
Sloane never chose that path, of course. Never thought to raise a family, lest it be yet another excuse for the men in power here to keep her from rising in the ranks.
But now she wonders what her life would have been had she gone that route. A family. A husband. A daughter like Adia.
as Sloane steps into the turbolift, Adil follows after and hands over a data pad with an adjusted schedule. The door closes behind them, just as it closes on Sloane's fantasy of having a family. That dream is one that has come too late, she decides. Sloane takes the data pad, but doesn't look at it. Instead, her eyes stare off at an unfixed point 1,000 kilos away.
Is something wrong?
Adia asks.
The turbolift begins to move, taking them down into the lower levels of the Ravager, the Empire's last superstar destroyer. But therein, a question suddenly persists. Is it? She has taken it on as fact, but Rax said that fact and truth are separate things. Sloane reminds herself that it is time for a new accounting of all the naval ships. In fact, she stops the turbolift.
Adia,
she says,
I need your help.
The young woman looks around, confused.
Why are we...
Because this is a sensitive conversation, and I can't have anyone listening in whom I can't trust. And the list of who I trust is shorter than I would prefer. I admire Admiral Rax, but he's a cipher. I'm not sure I trust his hand to be steady in ruling the Empire yet.
Adia is one of those who is well aware that Sloane's power in the Empire is secondary to Rax's. Many of the officers on this ship know it, which means ultimately many in the Empire will know it soon enough. But Sloane can't concern herself with that right now.
I will launch another search into his history, Adia says.
No, I'll handle that this time. Not because I don't trust you, but because I need you on other things. First, get me a proper accounting of all the ships that were in Imperial service when Palpatine still lived. Second, I need you to put me in touch with the bounty hunter again. Find Mercurial Swift and arrange a meeting. Oh, and I'll also need a draft of a new breeding program initiative. For every child an Imperial has, they get a reward. Credits, perhaps. Or a boost to paid leave. Can you do these things for me?
I can.
Those two words, precious and perfect. I can. No argument, no question, just the affirmative.
Good.
What are you going to do, Admiral?
Everything's bound up in a knot right now, dear. A knot I can't quite untie. You know the best way to undo that kind of knot?
She smirks.
You cut right through it.
Interlude. Volusia.
The Atoll of Koloa. The mouth of an extinct undersea volcano, pushed up out of the water and given new life as an island. This island is a claw-shaped thing. Its soil rich and black, like powdered soot. The plants that grow up out of its small jungle are twisted together with bright flowers whose petals snap at the air as buzzing insects pass. Beyond the island is a ring of shimmering sediment beneath the sea, an aggregate of crystalline matter that, as it turns out, is actually composed of the fossilized corpses of gelatinous chomar, drifting sea creatures that look like diaphanous blobs of glowing flesh. The local Volusians eat them, Mon Mothma had said, before adding, raw. Leia shudders at that thought.
Her time as princess, ambassador, and general has led her through an unholy host of culinary trials and tribulations.
Pickled Koodler Roe on Goliath Maul. The texture alone was enough to haunt her. Half-rancid Durang fruit,
which tasted not unlike how death smells.
Skewered Mandler talk over an open fire. She admits that those little lizards were actually quite good, once you got past how they popped when you bit into them. Curiously, the worst of all remains the protein paste they sometimes had to eat in the early days of the Alliance. Looked and tasted like Hulk Hawk. Actually, It might have been Hulkok, for all she knew. Eating strange things is what you do with galactic citizens that are not you, she reminds herself.
It is a welcome honor, if an occasionally uncomfortable one. Thankfully, that will not be her task today. The native Volusians do not occupy the island of Koloha. No one does.
She stands on the deck of a floating cruiser, what once was a luxury swift-wing pleasure liner, though it has seen better days. Much of what the New Republic possesses for equipment remains dinged, dented, blast-scarred, or just plain old. That is changing slowly as they ramp up their own political machine and oust the Empire system by system. But for now, this old thing, which transitions well enough from sea to sky to the stars, will have to suffice. As she stands there, a woman in white joins her. With her, that flash of fire-red hair that belies the woman's calm, placating smile. Mon Mothma has that effect. She is serene, even when she is worried, or when she is angry. Mon says,
"You seem uncertain."
"This is all more than a little deranged," Leia says. "What are we doing out here? This surely can't be a real plea."
"Maybe it isn't. It seems earnest enough. And it's not as if we're unprotected."
The Chancellor's eyes drift heavenward. There, beyond the atmosphere, is a fleet of New Republic ships. And ahead of them, on the atoll, their own soldiers. The most elite, the most capable, wait for what may come.
"They've already combed the island. Relax, Leia. We are safe."
"It could be a trap."
"You sound paranoid."
"As I should,"
Leia says.
"Every good thing in this galaxy seems to twist and turn in our grip like a serpent. Just as you think you've got it by the tail, it whips its head around and takes a bite."
"Where's that idealist I met on Alderaan?"
A rare smile tugs at Mon's mouth.
"We don't see enough of each other, Leia. I miss you. How's your husband?"
"He's good."
Leia lies. She adds another lie to the heap, because once you've set one down as the foundation, why not build a house and live there?
"His mission goes well. He's a changed man."
Mon watches her. Is that suspicion glinting in her eyes? Or just more paranoia on Leia's part?
"I gather it must be hard being married through all of this. But I promise that the transition will be over soon enough. And peace and prosperity, and stars help us, a little normalcy, will return soon enough."
Again, her eyes tilt skyward. Leia sees it too. A ship entering atmosphere. A nondescript minecraft. A Kinro 974 symbol. Even from here, Leia can see the plasma scarring and the pockmarks from debris. From behind them, the voice of Staff Sergeant Hearn Kavin, a bearded Pantoran who works on the protective detail around the Chancellor. Leia has been told she needs a protective detail as well, but she is told then she will be her own protective detail, thank you very much.
"He's here, Chancellor," Kavin says.
Behind the mining ship fly two flanking Y-wings, weapons ready just in case.
"He's alone?" Leia asks.
"It's just one ship, and only one biosig aboard."
On the atoll, a space has been reserved upon the beach for landing, and the Kinro 9747 hovers over the makeshift pad, its exhaust blowing a hissing wave of sand into the sea before finally settling down. A passel of New Republic soldiers, their weapons raised, surround the ship. As soon as the landing ramp descends, the soldiers storm inside. Despite the warm, balmy sea air, Leia suddenly feels cold. She knows what could come next. The ship suddenly detonating, killing those men. Or maybe it would be filled with something worse. A biological agent. A chemical weapon. Some starving creature, like a cybernetically enhanced rancor monster. At this point, nothing would shock her short of the black, gleaming visage of Vader himself stepping off that ship and into the sand. But then, Kaveen confers with the soldiers on the comm. He relays their response.
Chancellor, they've given the all clear.
Ma nods. And that's all it takes. The soldiers escort the pilot of the mining ship off and onto the beach. Ma Sumeda is an imposing figure. His Shagrian skin is the blue-gray of troubled waters, failing to match the bright aquamarine of the ocean here in Volusia. And his long, horn-tipped tentacles give him the cut of something sharp and poisonous, which, Leia supposes, is not entirely inaccurate. There stands the man who was once Emperor Sheev Palpatine's chief administrator and has now become the proxy emperor, at least in name and in politics. He watches them from the beach. His gaze remains fixed upon them, in fact, even as the soldiers bind his hands behind him and help him step onto the sea speeder. The craft pivots in the water and flies toward the old pleasure liner, twin trails of sea spray cast in its wake.
Here we go, Leia says.
As they approach, she sees that the imposing figure is less so now. He looks old, weathered and worn. The tentacles topping his head seem wilted. His stare is hollow and, dare Leia say it, hopeless. The sea speeder slows to a halt below the deck of the pleasure liner. Leia and Mon step to the edge, looking down at him.
May I come up?
He asks. He offers a lifeless smile.
No,
Mon says.
You will speak to us from where you stand.
He wastes no time.
I offer myself to you as prisoner. I, Grand Vizier Mos Amida, head of the Imperial Ruling Council, turn myself in to Chancellor Mon Mothma and Princess Leia Organa of the New Republic. Take me away.
It's Leia's turn to say it.
No.
Tectonic shock crosses his face.
What?
We do not accept your surrender.
He turns suddenly toward the soldiers, panicked.
Will you kill me? Here and now? It's not in you. It's not like you. This isn't...
Mon calls down.
Calm yourself, Moss. We do not execute our prisoners, or those trying to be our prisoners.
We simply don't accept you as a prisoner, Leia adds.
But...
he stammers.
I am the head of the Galactic Empire. I am its pinnacle. No target is greater than me. I am a prize.
You're a figurehead,
Mon says.
I know things. Names. Details. I can help you. I came all this way. I fled the throne world.
His voice booms, but the desperation in it is keenly felt.
I will not be denied my surrender. It is against the Galactic Accord of Systems, established in the 50th year of...
The Empire has long ignored the Accord. It is considered obliterated, thanks to your efforts. And the names and details you know are, I suspect, far less impressive these days than you'd have us believe, Mars.
Leia smiles.
But there is a deal to be struck here. If you're willing to make it, Grand Vizier.
Anything! Anything at all!
Sign a treaty of surrender.
He laughs at first. And then the laugh dies in his mouth.
You're serious? You want me to surrender? The entire Galactic Empire?
That's right.
I don't...
But again, he swallows the sound. Leia suspects what he was going to say, and she helps him finish his statement.
You don't have the power, do you?
I...
So get it back. And then bring a treaty to our door. That,
the Chancellor says,
is the only deal we will make. And the only deal that earns you a life beyond this existence. Anything less than that will be met with a charge of war crimes and a brutal trial to follow. If your own people don't jettison you from an airlock first.
How do I accomplish this?
Mon shrugs.
You're an administrator, so administrate.
Then, with a curt nod, the soldiers turn him back around, facing the island. The Sea Speeder's engines thrum to life, and it returns to the atoll. All the way, Masamita protests and pleads until his voice is swallowed by the sound of the sea. In the distance, they watch as they shove him off the speeder and onto the sand. They cut his bonds. He's left standing, gaping, shocked.
It was our only play,
Mon says.
I know. For a big fish, he's surprisingly little. Still, I worry we just made a terrible mistake. It could have been a coup. We could have spun it as a victory for the New Republic. True. But you don't strike me as the type to want to spin anything. Unless war has changed you.
Leia sighs.
It is not. I'd rather play the long game and secure a real victory, not a ceremonial one. Good. Now let's get back to Chandrila. The war goes on.
Chapter 4.
They expect a fight, but the TIE following after the Halo turns back before breaking atmosphere and returns to the surface of Vorlag. Considering how those things are usually like burrs stuck to your back, Nora half wonders if there's something they don't know. Maybe they're flying into a trap, or out into some random asteroid field that the TIE would never survive. And even then, wouldn't it continue to follow? But the Imperial fighter turns and goes, lobbing off a few lazy shots before peeling away and disappearing. Temin sits at the controls and says,
"That was weird."
It was.
Though she starts to round on a theory.
Maybe the Empire is hurting that bad. Maybe they can't stand to lose even a single TIE. Or maybe they just don't care anymore.
You mean, maybe we're winning?
Temin asks.
Maybe we are, Tim. Maybe we are.
The burst of confidence and comfort in her heart doesn't last long. Outside the cockpit, in the belly of the Halo, loud voices rise in a clamor.
Uh-oh. Stay here and start setting hyperspace coordinates, she tells her son,
then gets up and heads into the gunship's belly. The Halo isn't big. The cockpit is cramped. The main hold can barely contain them all at once. Behind that is the head and the two-person brig, and then two bunk rooms. All the way aft is the engineering room, and it's not a room so much as it is a crawl space you have to shimmy up into in order to get anything done. This is a ship for quick trips, not long-haul flying. There isn't much privacy to be found. Arguments in this ship go big. They refuse to be contained. In the main hold, Jazz is crouched next to Sinjir, whose arm is swollen up like a blood-sucking bloatworm. He winces, his brow damp, as she dabs at it with some sort of goopy, tacky unguent found in a half-empty med kit up front. Bones stands nearby, beaked droid, head swiveling from person to person, to watch the exchange. Above her stands John Burrell, angrily berating her and punctuating every word with an air stab of his thick, calloused finger.
You don't just change the plan without giving us some kind of signal. We could have been killed, Amari. We could have...
The bounty hunter stands up fast, like she's ready to strike.
But instead, all she does is smile and pat his cheek like he's a child and she's his mother.
I didn't change the plan, Burrell. That was the plan all along.
His face is dumbstruck. Jom looks to Nora and wordlessly asks an obvious question.
What is she talking about?
But Nora doesn't know. So she asks,
Jazz, what do you mean?
I mean,
Jazz says, opening up bins and pulling out drawers as if she's looking for something,
that I always planned it that way.
You didn't tell us that, did you?
Jom grabs her and wheels her around. But Amari breaks his hold fast and shoves him back hard.
Hey!
Don't,
she warns.
You planned to double-cross us all along, didn't you?
Jom asks. She shakes her head.
Triple-cross. I swear, Barel, you are as daft as that tatty carpet of yark fur you wear on your face.
Why?
Nora asks.
Why would you do that?
Jazz bares her teeth.
Did you see the bounty poster? We're all on it. My face included. I'm a bounty hunter with a bounty on her head. I have been compromised. There exists no way that Slusson and Gabby were going to just let me waltz in there and scurry around this dung pile of a palace like some little don't-pay-attention-to-me spider. I had a play, and I went with it. I sold you out. Then, when they were distracted with you, I snuck my way into Gabby's room and waited for him. I paid one of the stable slaves to put keys around the Horoth beast's necks. Then I waited.
A twinkle shines in her eye.
Besides,
she says, patting her pockets, they jingle.
That means I got paid twice, which is never a bad thing, right? I really do have bills.
You should have told us!
Nora seethes.
You don't get it, do you? This is what I do, but it's not what you do.
Jazz Amari's finger draws an invisible perimeter in the air, containing both Nora and Jom.
You're a pair of bright-eyed rebel saps in the bag for the good of the galaxy. You're not bounty hunters. You're not one of the bad guys. I am. I can fake it. I can lie and cheat and swindle and smile the whole time. That's not who you are. I can't trust you not to blow it.
Sinjir woozily lifts his blister red arm.
Ah, hello. I was told I might get a Bacta shot. Anybody? No?
Did he know?
Jom snarls, pointing at the ex-Imperial, then accusing Sinjir directly.
Did you?
I did not,
Sinjir answers, a bit testily.
I did.
They all turn. There stands Temin, beaming.
What?
He asks, showing his palms defensively. Nora sees a glimmer of his father in the boy's eyes. Just then, a playful, puckish gleam.
Jazz trusted me and said it was the right thing to do. She said I had to be ready.
Nora gapes. Her son lied to her.
Again,
she reminds herself. She does her level best to tamp down the sudden flux of anger rising inside. But she feels suddenly, woefully out of control. Like things are slipping out of her hands and spiraling away. Her son, this team, this mission. So when Jom points to her and says,
Control your boy.
He is the unwitting recipient of her fury, lashing out like a crackling vibro-whip.
I'm the leader of this team,
she says, her words hissing through clenched teeth.
Not you. I'll handle him how I choose.
Maybe you shouldn't be leader,
he says with a half shrug that somehow manages to be aggressive.
Well, she is our leader,
Jazz says, shoving past him.
You don't like it? Go find another starship to hit your grav ref to. I'm sure spec forces would be glad to have you back, stinking up their air with your ego. Now get out of my way, Barel. I need to get that back the shot and some gauze for Mr. Calamari arm over there.
At that, Sinjir pouts.
That hurts my feelings.
More than a little. Nora wheels on her son and pokes him in the chest.
You,
she says under her breath,
you and I will have a conversation about this.
Uh-oh,
he says.
Uh-oh is right,
She's hoping for now the fight is done, but it's far from over. Even as Jazz excuses herself to search the bunk room for another medkit, preferably one with a Bacta shot, Burrell follows after her, still barking mad.
"Wait right here,"
Nora tells her son, then goes to break up the fight once and for all.
"I knew I never should have trusted you,"
he says, standing in the doorway as Jazz roots around in one of the underbunks.
"Bringing some bounty hunter on board. And Tilly's must have had his head knocked around real good while caught in the Empire's clutches."
Jazz laughs, finally finding a capped Bacta shot.
"You've got it spun around, Burrell. This team needs someone like me. They don't need some thick-skulled, law-bound brute who has all the imagination of an overturned minecart. We need moral flexibility."
"I'm flexible. I've got imagination."
He storms into the room, fists at his side.
"I'm not just one of your marks. I can handle myself."
Whap! Jazz slaps him hard with an open palm.
"Can you? Really?"
He reels for a moment, rubbing his face. His jaw crackles and pops as he moves it left and right. That moment is over fast.
"Why, you little..."
He growls and steps into a fighting stance, two fists up in front of his face, legs placed apart. Jazz begins to pace the half circle in front of him, her limbs down and loose. He bats at her, but she blocks it. She kicks out with a leg and he turns inward, taking the hit on the outside of his knee. The two of them move around each other like a pair of wild-eyed creatures shoved together in the same cage. Nora shouts,
"Quit it, both of you! You're not a couple of mating Murrah locking horns!"
The Spec Forces officer slaps at Jazz with a wide paw, but she bows her back, handily letting it catch open air. The bounty hunter moves fast, hooking her leg around his and wheeling herself onto his back. Her arms tuck under his pits, and her fingers lace behind his neck. Chum roars. He tilts back, his boot jabbing out and connecting with the door controls. And the bunk room portal slams shut. When Nora tries to open it, she finds it locked. Inside, the clamor rises. Something falls. Bang! A rattle. Grunting. Suddenly, the space outside the door is crowded. Temin to her left, Sinjir to her right. The droid, Bones, humming some mad song behind.
"Can either of you get this door open?"
she asks. She tries the button again, but the door won't budge.
"Man, they're really fighting,"
Temin says. Sinjir tilts his ear toward the door. His eyes narrow.
"Well, they were fighting.
Still sounds like they..."
But the boy's eyes go big as moons.
"Oh."
Even Bones whistles, a warbling, discordant note. Which means that Nora is officially the last one to figure out what's going on. They're not in there fighting at all, are they? Beyond the door, something bangs, then rattles, then falls. Jom growls. Jazz laughs. Kissing sounds. Those are kissing sounds.
"I choose to ignore all of this for now,"
Nora says, taking a deep breath.
"Tem, go plot for hyperspace and get us back to Chandrilla. And take him with you."
By him, she means Bones. The boy and the droid wander off, leaving Nora and Sinjir standing in front of the door.
"I never got my Bacta shot,"
Sinjir says.
"I think you're going to have to wait."
"If I wait much longer, I fear the arm might pop like a bladder bug. It really hurts,"
he pouts.
"It's really gross."
Nora sighs.
"Fine, come on. Let's go see if there's another med kit in the second bunk room."
In a sing-songy voice, he answers,
"Thank you, Mom."
"Don't call me that."
"You're no fun."
"That is becoming abundantly clear, Sinjir."
The halo drops out of hyperspace. There, looming into view, is Chandrilla. A small, blue-green planet, now the home of the nascent New Republic. Nearly idyllic, Nora thinks, with its calm seas and rolling hills. The weather is mild. The seasons are present, but never dramatic. The people are peaceful, if a bit haughty and pedantic and over-invested in every political maneuver and measure that proceeds through the Galactic Senate.
This would be a good place to call home,
she thinks, then looks over at her son.
Are you good?
She asks. He cocks an eyebrow.
I'm golden.
She doesn't think he's lying, but her skill at reading people fails to match that of Syngier, who can cut you into your constituent parts with a half-second glance.
I need you to trust me,
she tells him.
I do.
He narrows his eyes.
This is about the jazz thing, isn't it? Mom, it's like she told you.
Life is a series of moments.
Nora suddenly stops talking, then pinches the bridge of her nose and sighs loudly.
Gods, I'm about to give you one of those talks, aren't I? I hated when my mother gave me these talks, and usually I went out and did the opposite of what she told me to do. And that's what you're going to do, because you're my son. So stupid.
Fine.
He rolls his eyes.
It's not stupid. Go on, give it to me. I promise I won't, like, barf into my hands or anything.
Nora hesitates.
It's just... I just want you to be good. To be good with yourself. And to know where you belong. Not where you think other people want you to belong, but where you really belong.